Good evening, everybody. My name is Devin. I am a recovered alcoholic. Really good to see all of you guys. I hope we had a nice holiday last weekend. Happy we're back. So really quick, I do have a sobriety date. It's August 28th of 2011. My home group is called No Serenity Till Brooklyn. We are currently still having to meet virtually, but we are a home group based in Brooklyn, New York, where I live, and I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, there's a couple of new faces, and then there's a lot of people that were here last time we were together. And one of the things that, you know, we had taglined this little four-week thing that I get to do here is our shared dilemma, I think. And so last time I was here, I kind of shared a little bit at length about my story, and I tried to share about the gravity of what alcoholism really is. And those were things that, you know, I didn't understand what alcoholism was for probably the first couple of years I was in AA, because no one had come to me and just broken down the information that was contained in the big book and said, you know, does your body look like this? Does your mind look like this? You know, have you felt like this? That's alcoholism. And I didn't have this like clear description of what alcoholism looked like for a little while. And so when I'm thinking about, you know, this idea that we have a common problem in Alcoholics Anonymous, we come here, we seem to have this problem where we can't handle how much we're drinking. And then we come together and we have this common solution, which we find in the 12 steps. But ultimately what the 12 steps are pointing us to is this God idea. That the real answer or the real solution that I need to have in my life is a connection with some kind of a higher power. And if I don't have that, I'm probably going to be sunk. And I'm probably going to die drunk somewhere in a ditch, or I'm going to end up in the ICU after a grand mal seizure. And, you know, it's just my life's going to end up one of a few ways that alcoholics kind of end up if we're not able to get a handle on this thing. And but what I remember last time before I got here, like having the thought about part of our common dilemma or our shared dilemma may be that solution is not the solution that we're looking for. You know, as much as I might identify that I have a drinking problem, I come into AA and you guys say the answer is a spiritual one. You're going to have a spiritual awakening and you're going to have to seek this relationship with God. And my mind snaps shut because what I bring to that is all the old ideas that I have about that word. And potentially what I'm not looking for is actual work that I have to do on myself, but I really just want like an easy answer. And so I wanted to kind of dive into a little bit about how I was able to kind of get exposed to that and the experiences that I had, the questions that were brought to me, and how I was ultimately able to kind of make a beginning in this 12-step program and kind of then ultimately lead up to making a decision in my third step to actively try to live this way of life. But for those of you that weren't here last week, in the briefest terms, you know, I am an alcoholic. I would consider myself an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. What I mean by that is ever since I was like first times drinking, something else seemed to be going on within me than other people around me. I think I told the story of being at the party in high school shortly after I'd had that first drunk. We were able to get a case of beer. My other friends were, you know, grabbing a couple of drinks, and I was literally the guy holding the case of beer at the party. Like, there's a little bit of a different level going on, it seemed, when I was starting to get going on this. You know, you guys might have a drink or two and be okay. I needed to know where the alcohol was because I was going to need it later. And I was going to need to always know how much I have, if I need to get more. You know, it was just a different ball game. And the idea that alcoholism presents on a physical level, showing that when I start, I can't control how much I'm going to drink every time. You know, I had that from the very beginning. I never had the off switch. I never fantasized about having a drink. The goal was not, oh, I'd like to have just a few drinks and unwind and, you know, go out and be social. It was like, I'm here to get drunk, man. And after a while, getting drunk looks like I'm blacking out. Looks like it's becoming, I'm waking up in the morning towards the end, and the first thing I'm doing is gathering whatever money I have and going to the corner store to get a 40 and taking a walk. And that was normal. You know, waking up and instantly starting drinking for me became very normal. And if that's the only experience you've ever had with alcohol, it's going to look normal. You know, I kind of looked at other people and was like, why aren't you drinking? You know, like, are you not getting what I'm getting out of this? Because what I'm getting is, like, on some levels in the very early days was freedom. You know, all the fear that I had, the insecurities that I had, the needing to try to impress you, to figuring out who do you need me to be so you approve of me, all that stuff was wiped away. And so alcohol became a very important part of my life because it allowed me to feel okay in my own skin. And I can report that my wife doesn't have that experience. You know, she's normal. She will start drinking and will forget that she started drinking. I don't know what that's about. You know, I'll come into the other room and she bought a six-pack last October. It was like pumpkin ale time or something. And she was really excited about that. And I went to grab the six-pack and put it in the fridge. And she was like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "Well, you're going to want these cold, right?" And she's like, "Oh, I'll just grab them one at a time when I want them." It's like, what? And it took her about 3 weeks before she had the last pumpkin ale or whatever it was. I mean, it's like literally mind-blowing. So if that's what sanity might look like, you know, I don't know what that's like. Because when I start, you know, I remember walking in and looking at, you ever have friends that have a bar? Like, how do you have a bar, dude? Like, how do you have multiple bottles of different types of alcohol at your house? I buy the bottle and it's gone before the night's over. Like, I can't collect these things. And I would walk in, like, "You want a drink? We got some gin, we got some tequila, what do you want?" I'm like, how do you do that? You know, so I have, yeah, right. I can't moderate that, right? So once I start, I can't stop, pretty clear. You know, and the way I look at that is I wake up in the morning and there's never any liquor left. And it's like, oh man, I guess I ran out. You know, and I always was running out the night before. So that's a big problem. And we talked about, you know, if that's the only problem, I just don't start drinking, I don't have a problem, right? But I don't think we end up in a church talking about 12 steps and all the stuff that we're going to have to do to try to stay sober and find a relationship with God if we could just come in here and say, "Well, I'm not going to drink anymore," and that works. You know, when I did come to AA on my own, because I really was waking up with a suicide plan. I was 24 years old and I'm in Brooklyn and I'm feeling useless to the world and I just want to die. And I'm showing up at these meetings and people said, "Just don't drink." And it was like the magic of North Brooklyn 10 years ago was, "Just don't drink. You know, come and see us again. Take my number, call me." They would say, "Play the tape through. Think the drink through." And it's like, that sounds really good. But my reaction, or my actual experience of that was every single day I would leave that meeting and within a short amount of time, I was drinking again. I don't know if any of you guys have experienced the wonderful smartphone battery drain that happens after you have it for a year. You know, you plug it in overnight, it's at 100%, you make 3 phone calls, you're like, "Why is it at 12%? What happened?" You know, it's like that was my experience. I'd come to the meeting, I'd get a little bit of charge from the people that were sober here, then I'd go back out into the world, and within an hour or so, that charge that I got from that meeting is gone. And all of a sudden, I'm drinking, and I don't know how I started. And I didn't understand that mental obsession piece, that the thought that starts is just, "Well, you could just have a drink, it'll be different." You know, all this little chatter that I have in my own voice is a much bigger problem. Because if I can't stay stopped, and once I start, I don't have an opportunity to get myself stopped again until I am stopped. That's a big problem. You know, why is it that my mind keeps bringing me back? And I think we talked about it, hopefully talked about it last time, that what's driving all that is the internal brokenness that I've always felt. You know, in the doctor's opinion, he uses the words restless, irritable, and discontent. You know, and to me that's like, what does that look like? You know, restlessness for me is wherever I am, I need to be somewhere else. You know, I remember I would have friends. In high school, I had opportunities. I did all this music stuff and fine arts stuff. And, you know, I ended up going to school for music. But all the kids that were in those programs in high school were in, like, church youth groups and stuff. And I was, like, trying to smoke weed and drink and, you know, swearing a bunch. And I was not, like, those people. I was like, I don't see myself wanting to hang out with you guys. Even though we had all these shared interests, I looked at them and I was like, oh, I can't be around you guys. You know, and I had to be somewhere else. Then I'd be at some party and I was like, well, maybe there's a cooler party. I need to go to that party. You know, wherever I am, I need to be somewhere else. You know, irritability looks like I'm just kind of perpetually frustrated. You ever walk through the world and it's just every little thing is just kind of sets you off? Like, it doesn't have to be a big deal. The guy cuts you off in traffic and it's honking and finger and, you know, yelling at the windshield. And it's like, well, hold on. Like, is that necessary? The guy had to get in. I had, you know, he had to merge. His lane ended. Could I not have just been like, go ahead, dude? And I've driven with people back then that would drive like that. And I was like, why aren't you angry? You know, and I had to realize it was my reaction to the situation that was causing this. And that's kind of what irritability looks like. I mean, I remember clearly, like, being in line at the bodega holding a 40 in money. Like, I've got money, I got like the $5 bill out, and I've got the 40, and some guy's like asking about scratch-off lottery tickets. And I was literally like going to hit him in the head with the bottle. Because I was like, can you just, I'm like, you know, the guy's like, oh, this is a, you know, and they're talking about all these lotto tickets. And I'm like literally holding beer and money. Like, come on, dude, let me just buy this. You know, it was like I almost just opened it and started drinking it. You know, because I'm like, I can't wait. Like, are you serious? You know, a normal person is like, oh, they're just, you know, he's helping the guy in front of me. He was here first. That would be normal. So there seems to be something going on where I'm not okay. And discontented, I always just ask the question today, like, do you have any joy in your life? You know, when you look out at your life, are you coming from a place of gratitude and able to look at all the beautiful things in your life and go like, wow, how awesome is it that I have, you know, this kind of a job, or I have this family, or I have all these things going on, or am I looking out at the world going like, man, where's mine? You know, this isn't enough. You know, it's like you get some new thing that you think you're supposed to get, and the new car smell wears off in about 10 minutes. You know, and it's not enough. And wherever I am, it's just not enough, and I need more. So I'm not able to just be at peace with myself. And so understanding today that that's like alcoholism in its totality, for me, is really helpful. You know, when I claim that I'm alcoholic, I'm not just saying I have a drinking problem. I'm saying what I have is a spiritual issue. And really what it looks like is I don't know how to be a human being, it seems. You know, my wife has the ability to express herself and let me know if I've said something that was hurtful. She can just kind of stop and say, hey, that wasn't really that nice, or that was kind of hurtful. You know, and I noticed you were feeling a little bit weird, so I left you for some space, and then you came in and were kind of, you know, almost like challenging me why I left you alone, and you know, that this is ridiculous. And she has the ability to just kind of call it out and let me know. She's got like an emotional balance that I just don't seem to have. And so getting to see that window with others has allowed me to understand, really, like I do have a spiritual issue. And so last time, I think we spoke at length about a lot of that stuff. And today, I guess I wanted to talk about, so what does it look like to come to believe in a power greater than myself? And if I need to be restored to sanity, well, what's the insanity? And what would it really look like to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of this God that maybe I don't even understand? You know, I was kind of brought through these first three steps at about 3 years sober from a guy, and he just said, look, he goes, read the book on your own time. He's like, what we're going to do is we're going to do the steps. And I'm going to present to you all the information that you need to understand. It's all in this book. And once you've taken this journey and had this experience, I want you to go back and read the book and tell me if all those promises that they talk about throughout actually happened to you. But right now, I just want to get busy doing the work of these steps. And so we sat down and he brought me this information. You know, he pointed me at the doctor's opinion. He pointed me at the chapter more about alcoholism. He pointed me to the lines in There's a Solution that talk about the main problem being my thinking, that I need to find a power or else I'm not going to be able to stop myself from starting. And he gave me that information. And he also kind of cliff noted that with, he basically said, I want you to call, the next time we talk, I want you to take me through the first three steps as if I was a newcomer. And he goes, if at any point you start saying something that is not in line with what the big book is saying, I'll stop you and we'll talk about where you got this idea. But he goes, you know, the purpose of us getting involved in these 12 steps, yeah, you're going to benefit from it and you're going to have this awakening. And the byproduct of this awakening is going to be you stay sober. But the real purpose of getting involved in this program is to get to the place where we can turn around and actually have a 12th step active in our lives. Or where you can put your hand out to somebody who needs help and show them some clear directions. And that was what I got involved with going through the big book, with that is in the back of my mind. Is the reason I'm going to do this is so that I can turn around and show somebody else. If I'm going to learn anything here, the purpose of that is going to be so I can go be of use to somebody else. And so that was a really cool thing. And so I want to read a little bit about this, and it kind of gets to that word of the dilemma. And we'll see where it goes. I'm going to read just at the bottom of page 44, kind of midway through 45, just a couple of paragraphs. But first, in the middle of 44, it gives us this dilemma, right? It says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. You know, so it's kind of like a joke, right? Do you want to go to the bitter end and see what it looks like to have cirrhosis of the liver, to have your kidneys start failing, to have you literally go through organ failure one by one and die this alcoholic death? It's really painful and it's really horrific. And anybody who has to watch a loved one go through that will really be suffering. Is that really... You can go that route if you want. Or you could try to live a spiritual life. And we come in as alcoholics and have to weigh that as a serious debate, which I think is hilarious. That you tell me, well, we're going to live a spiritual mode of living and we're going to find a God of our understanding and we're going to do it through these 12 steps and we're going to get busy trying to help others. And my initial reaction to that is like, I don't know about that, dude. You know, I mean, I'm waking up, I'm 24 years old, I have a suicide plan. I can't stop myself from drinking. Every time I drink, I'm blacking out. I have all these other drugs on the table that are happening as well. My life is really a mess. I've got pending felony drug charges in another state. It's not going well. But you tell me it's the God idea that's the solution here, and I question you. Meanwhile, you guys have meaningful lives. You're smiling. You're walking around talking about, you know, I remember hearing some lady talking about, man, we got this new house, now I have a second mortgage, and I don't know what to do. And I'm going, second mortgage? Like, how do you buy a house? You know, like, I'm living paycheck to paycheck. I can barely pay to eat food some days, and you're talking about having two houses. And I look at that and go, wow, that's a problem for you, lady. Why are you talking about that in the meeting? Rather than being able to understand, like, this is an alcoholic who has gotten a life that looks like I'm able to actually purchase property and have to manage things. And that looks a lot more successful than what I have going on. But I don't get to connect those dots. And then you hear somebody say, well, it's these 12 steps, finding a relationship with God that sustains me. And I'm going, I don't know, dude. I don't know. I grew up and I didn't have a church, so I don't know about this God thing. And, you know, and I have all these ideas about what that is. And so when I come in, it's like, do you want to keep living how you're living? Or do you want to try this? And I think maybe I'm wrong, but most of us in this room have probably come in and been a little hesitant about this being the answer. You know, I'm not necessarily looking for what you're selling, dude. And so they go on, though, at the bottom of 44, it says, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might. But the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how are we to find that power? And it goes on to say that's exactly what this book's about. So the good news for anybody who's relatively new or has questions about this stuff is we don't have to get creative necessarily in how we're going to make an approach to this God idea. All I need to really do is get into this book and take the directions, and ideally that's going to help with somebody who's done them, you know, these steps previously. You know, find somebody who's fired up, find somebody who seems to have a working knowledge of what we're doing, and ask them for help. And they'll take you right through this book, and they'll show you exactly where it says, at this point we do this, at this step we do this. So I don't have to try to make up my own program, which is really helpful for me. but we get to this idea, I think I'm coming in on a drinking problem, and you guys say, yeah, well, it's a drinking problem, it's a thinking problem, and it's also a spiritual problem. And the real dilemma that you have is that you don't have power to live differently. And the question is, do I like that idea? I don't like being told I'm powerless. To me, the idea of surrender and waving a white flag always felt like the way of weakness. You know, I'm not sitting here going, you know, I think about like the guys on the battlefield. Well, you know, we got the Nazis. They put the white flag up. They surrendered. We won, right? Go, you know, go us. And instead, I'm brought to this idea here, or when I actually surrendered on August 28th of 2011, I raised my hand and said, I'm screwed and I don't know what to do. And it was a cry for help. And it was a prayer and I didn't know it. And I said, if I'm not surrounded by you people or at another one of these meetings, I will be drunk and high tonight. It's going to happen. You know, and that was me surrendering. And what happened in that moment was like the door opened. And it said, you know, it was basically like, are you willing to try something new? And so if my dilemma is I don't have power to live differently, one of the questions I would invite us to ask, which they bring to us later, is they talk about part of my second step experience is I need to be convinced that no human power can relieve my alcoholism. And I would invite all of us to consider, what human powers did we try to relieve our alcoholism? And in this situation, I'm thinking about my alcoholism as this brokenness in here. You know, I tried women in relationships. I tried buying a bunch of stuff. You know, I tried judging that I was superior to everybody in the room and trying to live from that place of I'm better than you anyways, you know, so screw you. Any time that I tried to figure out an answer to my problem, I always fell flat and I continued to drink. So at 18, I was put in a treatment center, right? That didn't work. You know, the love of my parents, the love of my, you know, my sister, my family, my friends, that didn't work. You know, all the things that seemed to be where other people might be able to turn the corner and say, I'm going to live different, just seemed to fall flat for me. And I start again. You know, I remember being in this county jail in the state of Georgia, and I remember literally laying on the bed, looking at the ceiling and going, I don't belong here. I mean, I was arrested breaking the law. They have evidence bags full of stuff that's illegal in the state of Georgia. They have me dead to rights, and I'm laying in the bed going, I don't belong here. This is a mistake. You know, I have an inability to connect the dots that the way I'm living my life is actually causing these problems, and I blame everybody else. Well, none of that ever worked. And I came out of that more restless, more irritable, more discontented, and constantly needing to find a way to be okay with myself. And so I need to find some power. And one of the problems, if you happen to be like me, is there's a lot of old ideas and prejudice there. And I would offer that, you know, what is prejudice even mean? If I have prejudice against an old idea, or any idea really, today I understand it as anything I brought up to this moment right here and right now is a prejudgment, is an old idea. You know, a lot of times we hear, if you read that spiritual experience appendix, it says willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the indispensable qualities that I must have to bring to recovery. And indispensable just means I can't do it without it. So I must be willing to try something new, I must be able to be honest with myself, and I have to have this open mind. And what does it look like to have an open mind? You know, an open mind means that when I come into a meeting or when I'm living life and I'm present to it, I'm trying to take in the ideas of those around me and just be open to it. If I come in and I hear the word God and I just immediately know what that looks like for me, maybe that's an old idea. And so what this thing, what they say here over and over again in this chapter to the agnostic, in this idea of how am I going to come to believe in a power that's going to restore me to sanity? They talk about, are you open to the idea that maybe, just maybe, we could ask some questions about our conception of God? Maybe there's somewhere in there where I'm limiting the power of this power that's available to me. Or you may be like a lot of us where we say there is no God and I'm atheist and I'm saying screw it to all that. And so they, in the chapter to the agnostic, they kind of offer up a bunch of great questions of how I might make a beginning of coming to believe. So I'm going to read a couple little things on 46 and 47. First, they offer up the idea. They go, some of us come to this word God and we're violently anti-religious. They say we've been brought up with some kind of a church and we've been told that this is what God is and we just reject that. At the top of 46, they talk about we look upon this world of warring individuals, warring theological systems, and inexplicable calamity with deep skepticism. And so what does all that mean is, you know, you might be, if you're like me, I had to write inventory on the ideas of killing in the name of God. That was a principle I put down that I was not okay with. I didn't understand how we could be out there as human beings like lopping each other's heads off and doing these crazy things to each other all in the name of my God says that you're wrong. Like, that just doesn't make sense to me, right? And so that's what they're offering here. Is we might look out at the world and we might say, well, look at all these horrific things that humans have been doing to each other for millennia. How can there be a God if this is, you know, this kind of cruelty? Or we might look at, well, all my family members have died because of cancer and horrible heart disease and all this stuff. So there must not be a God because I'm getting this horrible deal. You know, all these horrible things have happened in my life that I never asked for. Maybe we were brought up and we were traumatized by our parents. You know, there's abuse that we've endured a lot of times. You know, a lot of us come here and we're broken, and we're like wounded creatures that have had some horrific stuff. And so it's easy to look at all these situations I've examined in my life, and now you're going to tell me there's a God. Well, where was God for me then, right? Where was my God then? Where was the God for all these people that had to endure this genocide? You know, we can get into that debate, and so they tried to address that in here, which I think is really profound. And what they say is, we found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results. Even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power which is God. And later on in the bottom of this, it says, much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with Him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. We found that God does not make too hard terms for those who seek Him. To us, the realm of spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men. So I'm going to unpack, because that's like a lot. But I want to unpack some of this stuff, because this is really where I got a lot out of this simple exercise. I didn't grow up with a church. I didn't grow up with a faith. You know, when I was a little kid, my mom took me to a Methodist church. And then my parents opened like a dessert cafe when I was maybe 4 or 5 years old. And they would be not getting home until like 4 in the morning, Sunday morning, like late Saturday night. And so I started staying with my grandma a lot of those weekends, with my sister. And church just stopped. And my dad had come out of, like, you know, Catholic high school, you know, like all sorts of the upbringing with super Irish Catholic, you know, grandparents, and his parents were really Irish Catholic. And he kind of went through that whole thing and was like, I'm good, you know, he's a really bright guy. And he was like, yeah, I'm okay. I'm kind of like falling away from that. And so when I grew up as a kid, I never had any kind of spirituality preached in the home. Or it wasn't something that I was really brought to. I had music. And music was a spiritual experience, although I didn't understand it as such. I just knew that this does something for me and I'm drawn to it in this physical way. I get the chills down my spine when I'm playing or listening to music. There's something for me there, right? But what they offer is, I don't need to consider, or you don't need to consider my God. What a great idea. You know, and it kind of comes out of Ebbie Thatcher, if you know any of the history, that, you know, the guy that came to Bill. He's drinking 2 bottles of gin. He's got like a bunch of gin, and he's just sitting there getting drunk. And he's having a conversation with his old drinking buddy, and his drinking buddy is now sober a couple of months through the Oxford group. And part of the, you know, Oxford group was kind of the precursor to AA. Like, most of what we do as far as the steps came from practices of this group called the Oxford group. And I won't go too far into history stuff on it, but essentially they... Part of their deal was their whole thing was they're going to turn their, you know, they're going to come in and they do a confession right off the bat. Step one was confession of your sins to a like-minded Christian. So they started with our 4th and 5th step. They immediately got in, here's where I'm falling short. Then they turned their lives over to the care of God. Then they said, you know, devote your life to God. But they kind of felt like you can't do that until you've cleared all that stuff out. So they came in on confession, then they dedicated their lives to God. Then they offered what they called restitution. And they went out in the world and tried to repair any of the damage they did. And then the last step was to go testify your experience and kind of maybe get somebody else involved in this movement, right? So that's kind of like our 12th step. So Ebby, kind of being a little bit ashamed about it, ends up going to his old drinking buddy Bill thinking, well, this guy's probably drunk. He's not even going to remember us having this conversation. But then I can go back to this group and, hey, I tried. You know, I went and testified for you. And he's sitting there with this conversation with Bill and they're arguing about God. You know, he shows up and he's going, I found God. And Bill says, he looks good. He's fresh skinned. He's glowing. He really looks good. And he's going, what's gotten into you, man? You know, last time you were here, we were getting smashed together and we had all these experiences over the years. What's going on with you? And he goes, well, I found religion. And so Bill's in his story is saying, well, now, this guy's like cracked out about religion, whatever. I've got more alcohol. It'll be fine. I'll just get drunk and, you know, let him go at some point. But towards the end of this, like, they're kind of arguing, and Bill keeps confronting him on the God idea, and Ebby just apparently, like, on the way out the door is, like, exasperated and just goes, I don't know, man, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And that got baked into our program, and I think, for me, I wouldn't be here if you told me that it had to be a certain God, right? So the good news in AA is there is no Alcoholics Anonymous God. There is an understanding that we all kind of come to after we take these steps and start this program, where there seems to be this unmistakable change that happens to us. We start I remember I was like 6 months sober and I was driving somewhere and I felt okay in my own skin for the first time ever. And I like laughed out loud to myself and I said, all right, man, I'm here, show me. You know, it was probably my first honest prayer. But it was the experience of I am sober, I'm actually feeling pretty happy, and right now my life seems to be kind of okay. I feel okay. I've never felt okay in my entire life if I was sober. So something was happening within me that I didn't even understand. But the idea that you don't have to think that my God can't be your God is kind of how I like looking at it. So you got to go get your own. And they say that no matter what our conception is, however inadequate, meaning I don't have to go and impress somebody with this grand idea of what God's going to be, I just have to be willing to seek a relationship with this power. And that's what I love about AA is it's not saying, they even actually tell us that it's going to be impossible to define and fully define and comprehend the power which is God. I was told stop trying to figure it out. I don't know if that relates to anybody, but literally it was like, if you're never going to fully define or comprehend this God idea, then stop trying to figure it out. And I see a lot of us coming in here and we kind of struggle with this. I got to have this idea. I got to figure out what God's going to be for me. And what I had the experience of was I just said, you know what? I'm screwed. I need help. You guys are able to stay sober. I can't. So maybe if I'm surrounded by you people, that's bigger than me. Maybe that's the beginning. You know, and I really walked in on that. I came in and I heard your stories and I realized you weren't lying to me. And in the 3 months that I couldn't stay sober, I watched people get 30 days and 60 days and 90 days. I heard people have multiple years. I heard the stories of other alcoholics that were now sober, and I related to how they drank, how they felt. And ultimately, when I looked at them, I said, I don't know how you can be up there and talking about this stuff so easily. So I came to believe first that Alcoholics Anonymous worked for you guys. And by coming to believe that it worked for you guys, I was at least open to the idea that if I'm around here and I'm participating and doing whatever you guys are showing me, then maybe, just maybe, I have a shot at staying sober myself. I didn't know what the insanity was. It was later brought to me that the insanity was that mental obsession piece. The fact that I can't connect the dots, that the alcohol is at the center of all the problems of my life. The fact that I'm unable to stop myself from starting, that I have these mental blank spots. You know, when you guys say, you're insane, I don't like that. But when I'm able to understand that the insanity I have is in my relationship to alcohol and that I'm going to need some power to right that, I got that. So I became willing to believe that AA worked for you first. As I've been sober a little bit longer, you know, I've done a lot of seeking, and now there's just this experience that's there. I could tell you at 18 months sober, I had no idea what I was going to do for work, and the phone rang and they said, do you want to go live in China for 2 months and play at a nightclub 6 nights a week? Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, I had a bunch of things like that that just started happening. And it's not necessarily on a monetary level that God's showing up. Because I don't believe necessarily in like the favor dispensing God where you're going to get the money when you need it. Because there's people that are sitting there going, I didn't get the money and I had to like lose the house. You know what I mean? But what happened was, as I continued to be open to this and continue to practice and continue to try to do what was asked of me here, I just ended up being okay. Whatever was going on in the outside of my life was going on, but I was okay in here. And that was where I got this experience of this must be the God that we're talking about, because no matter what life is throwing at me, I'm able to show up and I'm able to still participate and it's not killing me. So that was how I first made the idea. I love don't define and don't comprehend. And I love that really what I need to be open to is, am I willing to try? You know, and I will tell you that today, my second step experience is still happening. I have to come to believe every day that this God idea is still going to work. If I don't really believe that prayer and meditation inventory, like that this program in its entirety is going to work for me, then I'm probably going to stop doing it. You know, I have to come to believe every morning, and I do that when I get quiet, and I leave that space in the morning to try to affect a relationship with this God idea. That's me coming to believe every morning that there is a power out there, that if I'm willing to turn my life over to it and say, all right, man, I'm here. I don't know what you need me to do, but maybe you could use me today and I could be helpful to somebody. And maybe you could, maybe there's an idea or there's something that's happening that's beyond my comprehension. I'm just going to put my head down and try to do whatever it is you need me to do. You know, that's me coming to believe every day. And I love the idea they say, when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. So I have someone I sponsor, and she can't really get on board with the word God. For her, she uses like Jedi or, you know, some other term. And I just said, when I use the word God, I want you to think that, you know, like, let's not get hung up on the word, but let's think about what the significance and the meaning of this God idea is. You know, if I can't stop myself from drinking, and if I literally want to die, I need some power here that's going to work. So whatever it is that you need to come to as a conclusion works for me. So if I say God and you need to think something else, please do that. You know, if I say God, don't think about an idea that doesn't work for you. But maybe what we should do is throw out all that stuff that isn't working for us and try to have a new experience. One of the things that I've done with a couple of people, I was just talking to Jim beforehand, is I sponsor a guy in Brooklyn. My home group's right around one of the Orthodox Jewish communities. In like Crown Heights, there's a huge enclave of the Hasidic and Orthodox Jewish people right there. There's like tons of synagogues, and it's actually really cool. I'm learning a lot about the culture that I knew nothing about. We have, you know, some of the rabbis and stuff are like in my home group. Like, this is wild. And this kid showed up one day, and he is the only one in his family who left the religion. Like, everybody else is still practicing. He's got like, you know, I don't know, 7 or 8 brothers and sisters, the parents, everybody's still observing the religion strictly, and he's the only one who said, like, this isn't for me. And what we ended up having to do was inventory what God can't be. Rather than try to figure out what is God, let's look at what God couldn't be in order for me to be on board. And so maybe part of my second step questioning and looking at my prejudices and old ideas needs to be about, well, what is the bar from entry? You know, it's kind of like if you're a little kid and you're going to the amusement park and they say you have to be this tall to ride the ride. Well, what am I saying is that line that I won't accept this spiritual answer? And maybe I need to look at what I'm considering to be the problem of why it can't be this answer. Now, why does God not work? And then am I willing to set that stuff aside? And that's what they say. They say, do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. Thank God it's an individual journey, right? Thank God that the 12 steps are designed to have each one of us have our own personal experience with this idea of a God. If I was told that I have to believe a certain thing and I was given a bunch of orders and you got to pray this way and you got to do this thing and you got to, I would be out the door. I would not be here today. But you guys said, no, the realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, and all-inclusive. Come to your own conclusions about this stuff. Just come and join us and try these things out and measure the results. I might have talked about it last time, but you know, we just had this pandemic, right? And we're kind of still in it. And now we have a bunch of these, you know, different kinds of vaccines and stuff. And if you were in the beginning, these companies came out and they said, hey, we have something we think is going to work. And what does we, the public, say? Well, we say, show us. You know, and this could be for any, you know, anything like this. You know, I need data. I need to know, like, before, if I even considered taking this thing, I want to see some data. You know, I'm not just going to take your word for it that it works, right? And so they do all these trials and then they come back and they say, hey, here's the data that we have, right? And that's kind of what this is about. You know, the 12th step says we're going to have a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And so my buddy said, you know, you're the laboratory. You know, the experiment is if you surrender to this powerlessness, you're open to doing these things, and you take these 11 steps into your life, the hypothesis here is that this will actually solve the drinking problem. That by having this awakening, you won't need to take a drink anymore. You'll have some sanity in regards to being able to understand that you can't safely use alcohol. And ultimately, you'll have this experience where you'll understand that maybe there's some power out there and you'll be at peace with yourself and the world and you'll be able to go out and be free. But the only way I'm going to find out if that works is if I actually do the experiment, right? And so that's kind of what those, you know, all these clinical trials, whenever they're coming out with new stuff in the medical world, they say, this is going to work for, you know, lupus. Okay, well, show us, right? The hypothesis in Alcoholics Anonymous is you will wake up spiritually if you take this program and weave it into your life. As a result of that awakening, the byproduct here is sobriety. That was news to me. You know, AA doesn't even promise us sobriety. It says you're going to have a spiritual awakening if you do this stuff. The byproduct of that awakening is that you learn enough about you and you address that brokenness within yourself that then you'll be able to go out into the world and be at peace with yourself. That you'll be able to experience loss and hardship and all these things that we struggle with as human beings. And you'll be able to do it with some grace and dignity. That you'll be able to still hold on to an inner peace no matter what is crumbling in your life around you. And to me, that's a much bigger message. There is depth and weight in that. You know, if you guys just said, you know, just put the plug in the jug and that was the only answer, like, I'm out the door, because that didn't work. And so, if I'm open to questioning that stuff, and I'm willing, and you know, I came, as I said, I came to believe by meeting you guys. I met people that were sober, I heard your stories, and I said, you guys aren't lying to me. I believe you. You know, you guys are talking about this alcoholism thing and the drinking game in a way that makes sense to me. You know, when people come up and talk about puking stomach acid the next morning because that's like literally all they have left for trying to drink. I remember I was like visiting my sister. I was trying to eat and they're like, here, an apple's good in the morning for a hangover. And I like took one bite of the apple and I'm instantly in the bathroom and it's like the green bile is coming up because I have nothing left in my stomach because all that night with alcohol poisoning, I had just puked nonstop. You know, when people are talking about that stuff, if you think you're the only person that's ever like hung around by the toilet for a bunch of hours and had the dry heaves and you meet somebody else, you're like, all right, I mean, the only way you're going to know about that is if you experienced it, you know. And then you're talking about being sober and that God was your answer. You go, well, okay, I guess I got to tune into that. But then we come to this idea, and maybe you guys have heard it a bunch. It says, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it, right? And I'll hear a lot of people just say, you know, just turn it over. You know, oh, you got this problem in your life. Oh, just turn it over. And I remember being new and going, how do you do that? You know, what do you mean just turn it over? And they'd say, yeah, you know, oh, you take your will back. Oh, you just turn it over again. And it was like this nifty little thing. And I'm like, how do we do this? And thankfully the book says, once we get to this third step, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood Him, the next sentence on page 60 is, just what do we mean by that and just what do we do? You know, it's like as soon as I got into the big book, all the questions I had about what do these things mean, they answer. It's like they knew what we were going to think and what questions I was going to ask, and they started bringing me to this stuff. And the way it's written from about page 60 to, you know, page 103 is like, it's a blow-by-blow of if I'm open to the solution, this is how I get involved. Let me think about where we want to go, because I want to talk next time, I guess, about what this like house cleaning stuff looks like. And then I was thinking about coming back on the last week and really talking about what like 10, 11, and 12 looks like, and what it, you know, and try to give like a really brief overview of like the entirety of the program. But I'll just read these ABCs of how it works. So if I'm going to sit down and have the opportunity to, you know, someone says, hey, can we do some steps together? I tend to start right here at the ABCs of how it works. What it says here is our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. You know, that was the bulk of what I talked about last time, what we were talking about a little bit today, right? You know, I can't manage my internal life. I can't just be happy in the world. I can't go out and just live different. I know that I'm a good person deep down, yet the actions that I'm living are not really the actions of good people. And I just can't seem to do any better. I need to be convinced of the idea that probably no human power can relieve my alcoholism. And so we talked briefly today. What did I try? You know, going to meetings and not doing any steps is a human power. I mean, you might get some power by being here, but if I'm not willing to do anything outside of the meeting, I'm not willing to get a sponsor, do some service, call some people, get involved, and all the other stuff, that's not really going to sustain me. You know, having children and wanting to be a good parent or being, you know, having parents that love us or, you know, that's not going to work. You know, having a significant other pleading with us, please don't go drink, that's not going to work either. Getting a big job and having six figures or seven figures in the bank account, that doesn't seem to work either. You know, buying the new boat, like whatever we try to throw at alcoholism seems to fall short. And I think each of us probably have a list of stuff that we tried. I really thought if I got to this point in my life and I did this, then I'd be able to go and live differently. Did it ever work? You know, and I think the joke is, if it worked, I wouldn't be here. Right? If it worked, I would have just lived a happy life and I would have said, all right, cool. That was funny years. You know, it was the college years. It was really crazy. And then I'd go on and live my life. And I have friends that did that. I have friends that I was drinking with, partying with, doing a lot of the same drugs with. My buddy showed up to Brooklyn. He met his now wife and immediately did an about face on all that stuff. He looked like he maybe had a similar problem to me. But when he met somebody, or if a doctor comes and says, dude, your liver's looking pretty bad, you should stop. There are people that look like alcoholics that have the ability to stop and live differently. And I'm not one of them. I can't relieve my alcoholism on any kind of basis of self-knowledge or any kind of warning. You know, you go in, even in like treatment, you go to treatment and the counselors are going to say, you're going to die. I'm like, dude, I want to die. Like, I literally have a suicide plan. You can't scare an alcoholic. Because if you're really in late stage chronic alcoholism and you've got this mind that's really going nuts, you want to die. Because the drinking isn't even working anymore. You know, when you're drinking to blackouts because the best you can do is at one point I'm going to pass out and I'm going to blot all this out and it's just going to go away. When that becomes that's the operative goal of your drinking, there's not any joy in that. You know, there was a time where I got drunk and it was fun. And at the end for me, it was just I need to black out because I can't live life sober and I can't live life drunk. You know, so that's a real problem, and that goes really deep. And the last idea that they throw on the table is that we need to be convinced that God could and would if he were sought. And the word that I have circled here is sought. You know, I don't have to believe that God can and will necessarily, but I need to have some idea that if I actually go after this solution, that maybe, just maybe, what everybody else around me is kind of suggesting could work for me. The next sentence that this thing offers is, if I'm convinced of these three ideas, I'm at step three. So when I'm getting to people and kind of we're going to sit down and get coffee and talk about this stuff, this is the three points that I want to address with somebody to find out where you're at. If you aren't convinced that you're alcoholic and can't manage your life, well, then we need to talk about this first step stuff. If you think that maybe if I just could get the next promotion at work and that's going to be the answer, well, then maybe you need to go and get that promotion and let me know if it works. You know, if you're not convinced of these ideas, then maybe you're not at the third step. But if you are, and some of us come in and we are, there's people that come into AA. I met a guy, a friend Jeremy, and day one, he was crying in the corner. We were at this 9 a.m. meeting in Williamsburg, and he was like, you know, bawling in the meeting. He was like really in pain. And I was sitting next to him, and he like didn't want to share. They were like asking if somebody was new. And I just kind of, you know, when you know someone's new, you're like, dude, you're like sitting here crying in the meeting. I've never seen you before. I'm like nudging him, and he raised his hand and was like, I'm back on day one or whatever, you know. And he thanked me for giving him a little nudge to say something. And you know, we went out to the diner, and he was still drunk, I think, from the night before. He like bought steak and eggs and just like pushed it around his plate. He's like, I can't even eat this, you know. And he just had this plate of food that he couldn't eat. And we started talking about this stuff, and after a while, in the diner, he put his fork down, he looked at me, he goes, I know what you're doing. And I said, what am I doing? He goes, well, you're 12-stepping me. And I said, uh-huh, how do you feel about that? And he goes, I need it. You know, and he started talking about it. He goes, I have an aunt who's like 20 years sober. When I was 19, I had a year of sobriety. I went to a bunch of meetings. Like, I know this works, and I know that I need to do this, and I'm dying. And we hung out for a couple of hours, and that ended with us, you know, saying this third step prayer together on a park bench in a park right there on the corner. And I drove over to a Staples, and I bought him a notebook, and I gave him a pen, and I said, start writing a list of everybody you're pissed off at. You know, 2 months ago, he called me. He had 5 years of sobriety, and he goes, dude, I'm waiting for life to suck. He's like, I got some money in the bank. I got this amazing relationship with this girl. We're already talking about, like, moving in together and possibly marriage. Like, my daughter is in my life now. I get her for 3 nights every weekend. I'm just kind of waiting for a shoe to drop because I don't know how to deal with life being okay. And so when we met, he was right at all these ideas. And he wasn't it wasn't like, oh, let's start reading the book. It was like, let's get going, man. Because sometimes I believe that we if we're really suffering from late stage alcoholism, we don't have time to wait. Maybe I need to seek God right here, right now, today. Maybe I'm 10 years sober and that power's kind of dwindled down and I just haven't charged it up. Maybe I really am on shaky ice and I don't know. You know, maybe I need to get reacquainted with this. And so I always start there, and then we just talk about, like, what does it look like to not play God in my life? And I'll get to more of that. I got only a couple minutes here, and I'll get to more of that next week, I think. But ultimately, for me, a lot of us, you'll hear, will say, well, make a decision to do the rest of the program. You know, I believe that really, in the very beginning, my decision in a third step is that I'm gonna start writing a fourth step. You know, and people have probably heard the old analogy about, you know, three frogs on a log. Everyone heard this one? You know, you got three frogs on the log. One of them decides to jump off. How many are left on the log? Well, three. Because the he didn't actually jump. He just made a decision to jump, right? And it's kind of like this old-timery bad joke, right? Obviously, no one's laughing, so it's not a good one, right? My delivery was probably really bad, too, intentionally. But the reality is, you know, for years I said, I'm going to go and go to the gym and try to get in shape. And it took 7 years into sobriety before I actually got into a gym. You know, did I make a decision 7 years prior to go to the gym? Or was it when I finally went and was like buying gym shorts and bought the membership to the gym and showed up that first day that I'd actually made that decision? You know, and so I think we could be in AA meetings for 5 years, but if we've never really gotten involved in these steps, we've never really made a decision to try what this is about. And that's not to say that going to a bunch of meetings isn't a big part of this deal. Absolutely it is. But if I want to get involved in what we would, you know, what this common solution of living a spiritual life is going to look like, I need to make a decision and follow that through with the action that's going to be writing some inventory, getting acquainted with the parts of myself that have actually been causing my failure, looking at the damage I've caused and being willing to go and take accountability for that, and then trying to live that a day at a time. And ultimately do what my second sponsor, Ron, talked to me about, which is you're doing this so you can go help somebody else. You know, I got to talk to my buddy Dave yesterday, and Dave just had 3 years of sobriety recently. And I saw him on Friday night for the first time in person after through most of this pandemic. And it was like, you know, it was amazing. We just gave each other a hug. And it was like, dude, so good to see you. And his lady was there. And he let me know that, you know, they're really seriously talking about next steps in their relationship. And he's like, you know, been purchasing stuff and has got a plan. And it was like really awesome. He's like, I don't know if I told you, man, but we're, you know, I bought a ring. I was like, no, you didn't tell me. And, you know, and 3 years ago, this guy literally was like suicidal and couldn't stop himself from drinking. And so what I'll offer is, you know, I came to believe that this program worked. I made a decision to get started doing it. And what I've really gotten is not only acquainted with facts about me, I understand how I operate in the world a lot better than I know me better than I ever did, right? And I know I've got this crazy self-righteousness and pride. And I can, if I'm really disconnected, I'm judging everybody. It's really bad. If I've got God in there, I'm like discerning. I can maybe decide who's a safe person for me to talk to and who's, you know, I don't need to like disclose all my information to. And, you know, I can kind of feel who I should be, you know, maybe spending time with or not. But if I'm disconnected, you know, I'm out there and I'm self-seeking and I'm judgmental and I'm critical and I'm a nasty. It's nasty. It's gross. And I'm trying to seek validation for all those ideas by nonstop talking about all the things that are bothering me in the world with everybody in my life. Because if I can get you to agree that I'm right, then I'm right. And I can go on being pissed off and right. And this thing suggests that if I do that, I won't be able to have this power in my life. But as a result of coming to believe and practicing this stuff, I've been set free of that. And more so, I've been able to be given some simple practices that on a daily basis I can try my best to do, and then I can sit down and show other people kind of what that's about. And you know, and I got to do that today. I got a young kid, he's like 21, he's also a musician, so we're getting to connect on all the music stuff. And he came over and we were just talking about this fourth column in our inventory. And he was laying out some situation, and he's right. You know, yeah, this guy's wrong. And we kind of spoke about, you know, yeah, that dude is wrong, but why does it bother you? You know, and after, you know, us hanging out for a little bit and asking him some questions, he goes, oh, I'm starting to see this a little bit different. This is really cool. And I think that's what this is all about. As I met you guys and you allowed me to start questioning beliefs that I held, you started having me question ideas about who I thought I was in this world. You had me look at what I was afraid of and what I'm resentful at. And in that way, you said that God was going to show me some truth about myself. And as I learned about me, I then became able to start helping somebody else. And today, when I get to have these kinds of phone calls, it's the most exciting thing ever. You know, that the little kid that I was talking about from the Jewish community called me last weekend and said, somebody asked me to sponsor him. What do I do? I was like, this is the greatest call ever. Because now we're not going to talk about you anymore. We're going to talk about how you can help that guy. And you're going to start getting the experience of when you start trying to help somebody, it helps you. So I don't know if any of this actually made any sense. The way my brain works is the ADHD mind that I have is I kind of start somewhere and then I just kind of go. But I want to open it up in case anybody has anything that you guys wanted to talk about. And I hope, if anything, that you know, this idea of making a beginning is a little bit simplified in the sense of we don't have to figure out what God is to start seeking God. You know, and I don't have to like have all the answers. What I have to have is an open mind and a willingness to try some new stuff and to take direction. And my experience is with that open mind and being willing to take some direction, something happened. And I remember I was at a meeting once in the 11th step, and this guy said, you know, I think God is something. He goes, because there's a moment in every one of our stories where the only word that we can use to describe what happened was something. You know, it's like our language seems to fall short when we try to define what God is. It's like, well, I was living life, and then one day something happened, and I never had to drink ever again. I can't really define it beyond that. And more so today, you know, if I were to say, what's my definition of God? It's two words. It's God is. Because I'm here and I'm sober today. And that should not be possible for somebody like me. And not only that, but regardless of the fact that I haven't been able to sleep much and you know, the outside of my life's a little nuts, like on a whole, I'm all good. I'm not sitting here going, a drink's a good idea. And that's the greatest gift that I've ever been given, is that I have a peace within my heart that's allowing me to be here. And I know that that's available for all of us. But the price is, you know, destruction of self-centeredness. And am I willing to get in the weeds and try to destroy my self-centeredness every day? Anyways, I'm going to stop talking and I'm going to turn the meeting over to you guys. And I, you know, this is a lot of me talking and I really appreciate your attention. Because I always have a lot to say. But you guys just sitting here and listening, and I can hear you listening, it means a lot. So I really appreciate your attention and thanks for being here.